afternoon and welcome to Thursday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody today, who's taking care of other client business for all your gold and silver needs. Call her toll free at 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Thursday, August 26, 2021. Happy Dog Day, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, I know, it's also National Burger Day, Cherry Popsicle Day, even National Toilet Paper Day. I'm serious. But the one I'm celebrating honors our one-of-a-kind canine friends. So to my loyal 15-year-old Golden Retriever Molly, who's joining her sister Daisy over the rainbow tomorrow, and to loyal canine companions everywhere, thank you, thank you, thank you for your unconditional love. Let's get started with the market report. Looking at precious metals, a little bit of a topsy-turvy day. Gold ended up in the New York spot aftermarket up $2.60. Right now it's $17.94 an ounce. Silver down 31 cents to 23.65. Platinum down $19 at 983. Palladium, another nosedive, down $39 to 2,472. In the other commodities, we've got West Texas oil down about 48 cents a barrel, close at 67.88. Got international Brent holding above 70, down 71 cents, but at $71.54. Now, in the gold futures market, that actually was up $3.50 to just about $1,795 an ounce. Now, in the Treasury market, with the dollar index up about 0.23 today, it's at 93.05. Be interesting to see what happens tomorrow after Jay Powell's speech in the morning. The Treasury's 10-year bellwether yield up slightly. So let's call it flat at 1.346%. 5-year yield also flat at 0.844%. And the longer-term 30-year note down slightly at 1.942%. That comes after mixed foreign markets, bond markets. Germany up very slightly. Japan and the UK essentially flat, down ever so slightly. In the good old paper markets, up, down all around today. Got Dow Jones closed down 192 at 35,213. The broader S&P 500 down 26 plus to close at 4,400. We'll call it 70. And NASDAQ down 96 to close at 14,946. Yeah, just some interesting things in the precious metal markets today. Gold kept under pressure. Again, trading below 1,800 and just unable to find any bullish momentum. Again, following weaker than expected GDP numbers in the second quarter. This morning, Commerce Department said its second estimate for second quarter GDP showed that the economy advanced by 6.6%. That's up slightly from the previous initial estimate of 6.5, but notably below consensus expectations of 6.7. We'll get into a little bit more of that report in a minute. But first, we begin today's news in Afghanistan, where we awoke to news from the Pentagon that there were at least now two explosions near the Karzai International Airport in Kabul, where U.S. and other Western forces are rushing to evacuate as many people as possible out of the country. As of just a little while ago, there were several, but an unknown number of American and primarily Afghan casualties, civilian and military, according to the Pentagon, whose spokespersons were referring to the events as terrorist suicide bombings, likely from an Afghani group known as ISIS-K. The U.S. Embassy in Kabul described the earlier explosion as large and said there were reports of gunfire accompanying the bombing, urging Americans to avoid travel to the airport and its gates. The embassy had issued a security alert before the explosion, urging Americans to avoid the airport today. In the last 24 hours, Western forces have evacuated over 13,000 people on 91 military cargo aircraft flights. Since the mass evacuations began on the 14th, approximately 96,000 people have been airlifted out of Afghanistan. About 101,000 have been evacuated since the end of July, including about 4,500 U.S. citizens and their families. Now, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said there may be as many as 1,500 Americans there left to evacuate, a calculation he explained was difficult to pin down with absolute precision at any given moment, because a lot of them did not check in with the embassy when they arrived there, whether it was for business or macabre kind of pleasure, I would say. Blinken also said there could be other Americans in Afghanistan who ignored public evacuation notices and have not identified themselves as of yet. Yesterday, President Biden told leaders of the G7, NATO, UN, and the EU that the U.S. will withdraw its military from Afghanistan by the 31st, sticking to that deadline that had been negotiated with the Taliban by his predecessor. The president warned that staying longer there carries serious risks for foreign troops and civilians. And, of course, what happened this morning turning out to be somewhat prophetic, not to mention pathetic. About 5,400 U.S. service members are assisting with evacuation efforts, with almost 200 U.S. military aircraft dedicated to the mission. The Brits have another 1,000 troops assisting. The Taliban earlier yesterday had said that they will no longer allow Afghan nationals to leave the country on evacuation flights, nor will they accept an extension of the withdrawal deadline beyond the end of the month. Some pretty dour pictures and videos coming in from that country today. Now, back home, initial claims for unemployment insurance were little changed over the past week, hovering around pandemic-era lows as the job market shows some additional signs of coming back. First-time filings were 353,000 for the week ended August 21st. That's a very slight increase over the previous week's 349K. That was slightly worse than the estimate of 350,000 by economists. Now, a separate economic reading showed that second quarter GDP increased at a 6.6% annualized pace. Again, according to the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis second estimate. Taken together, the two reports show an economy, well, growing through the pandemic somewhat, despite concerns over sharply rising cases of the Delta variant. Interestingly, at least initially, and really throughout the day, markets showed little reaction to the news, indicating that a lot of this has already been priced in, probably. Back to the jobs front, weekly claims held around the best levels they've seen since March last year, though they're well above pre-pandemic levels and still showing some signs of flattening out. Now, continuing claims also showed little change, dropping 3,000 from the previous week to 2.86 million. However, the four-week moving average tumbled over six figures to just over 2.9 million. Now, the total of those receiving benefits across all government unemployment programs rose just about 12 million. A year ago, that total was nearly 27.5 mil. In the GDP revision, the second reading for the pace of all goods and services produced in the country came in higher from the initial estimate due almost entirely to an upward revision in non-residential fixed investment. Now, some cuts to the previous estimates for private inventory and residential fixed investment, along with the lower reading on state and local government spending, partially offset a higher number. So let's drill down on the second quarter GDP revisions, because there's some interesting, tidbits in there. Again, slightly lower than what was expected, 6.6, second quarter slightly faster than previously estimated. But more importantly, economists are now worrying that the Delta variant of the coronavirus is beginning to cause another slowdown. Reports from the Bureau of Economic Analysis show that the last quarter's expansion followed a 6.3 annual growth rate in the first quarter. But in recent weeks, a lot more economists have been downgrading their estimates of GDP for the third quarter, as well as for 2021 as a whole, as a result, as uncertainty governing the virus continues to grow. As a consequence, one of the consequences of the rising cases has been real-time tracking of consumer activities, especially for like airline travel and restaurant dining, has weakened in recent weeks. So among other things, there's a growing unreliability again of some of the data that are coming in. Now, today's revised estimate for consumer spending, which drives about 70% of GDP, was upgraded from 11.8 to 11.9, essentially the same percent, that is. The slight rise in the government's estimate for the second quarter reflects, in part, stronger business investment, which grew at a 9.3% rate, as well as export sales, which were up at a 6.6% rate after falling in the first quarter. Now, offsetting that strength was a bigger drag from cutbacks in business inventory restocking and weaker home building, which fell at nearly a 12% annual rate. That sector in particular has been hurt by surging prices for material, as well as the shortage of construction workers. Now, the too big to fails, the Wall Street banks like Goldman Sachs are cutting their forecasts for annual growth in the third quarter and over all 2021, one right after the other. Sachs falling from 9% to 5.5 now for the third quarter. Wells Fargo downgraded as well from 8.8 to 6.8. Economist Leslie Preston at TD Economics says the real question is how well spending is going to hold up. Some high-frequency indicators are pointing to a loss in momentum in spending as more consumer caution creeps in, as we talked and wrote about in our newsletter and blog the last couple of weeks, consumer sentiment taking a nosedive, foretelling possibly some bad news for the coming months. Now, Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, said he downgraded his forecast for annual GDP growth this quarter from 8.4, that's third quarter, to 6.5%. But he's still predicting that it's going to expand at a 6.4 annual rate in the fourth quarter of the year. And that would leave growth for the full year at a fairly significant 6.1%. Hello, China, are you listening? That would be the fastest calendar year expansion since 7.2% in 1984. Of course, that's a 6.1% gain from a lower GDP base thanks to the pandemic. Last year, the economy shrank 3.4% overall as the recession wiped out tens of millions of jobs and the productivity that goes along with that. The increase in services spending in the second quarter reflected a shift away from the goods purchased that many people had made while hunkered down at home to spending on services like haircuts, sporting events, and yes, vacation trips. Now, a day ahead of Jerome Powell's highly anticipated speech at the Fed's Jackson Hole Economic Symposium, virtual as it is, St. Louis Fed Pres James Bullard said today that the Fed should begin curbing its monthly stimulus efforts soon and have the process wrapped up by the end of next March, all to prevent the economy from a longer-term overheating. Several other Fed leaders also believe the Fed should reduce the pace of its monthly $120 billion purchases in treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. Bullard said the Fed's purchases were appropriate last year to support American business through the pandemic, but they now run the risk of creating bubbles in financial markets and runaway inflation. He's quoted here, "We do have a new framework. We did say that we would allow inflation to run above target for some time, but not this much above target. So for that reason, I think we want to get going on taper. Get the taper finished by the end of the first quarter next year." Well, we're going to taper this first segment. I hope you'll stick around for these few important messages. We'll be back here listening to Financial Survive.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, 1-800-375-4188. Right before the break, we were talking about comments made at the Fed's Jackson Hole Economics Symposium today by St. Louis Fed Prez James Bullard, who's talking about the Fed should begin its tapering process soon. Now, one of the other things he talked about as justification for this, for doing it sooner, is him seeing evidence that the Fed's bond buying blitz has started to create housing bubbles. I think that there is worry that we're doing more damage than helping with the asset purchases because there's an incipient housing bubble in the U.S. with the median house price approaching $400,000. And he added, we got into trouble in the mid-2000s by being too complacent about housing prices. So I think we want to be very careful on that this time around. Now, Bullard's known as a hawk among his peers, meaning he tends to be more apt to pursue higher interest rates as well as curbing easy policy sooner than his peers. Now, Kansas City Fed Prez and host of the Jackson Hole Conference, Esther George, joined Bullard in saying the economy has reached the point where the Fed can start to pull back on the monetary juice it's been providing. She is a little bit more explicit, talking about cutting back, announcing a taper in September and starting to taper in October. And again, with the consensus being it's going to take 6-7 months to go through the tapering process, that would be consistent with Bullard's comments about ending this in March. But, it's a big but, and we'll talk about this later in the program. Big question about whether Jay Powell's going to go there tomorrow, and if he does, to what level of detail. Now, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. This week's topic is love, honor, and sheep. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, sheep. You may have seen this today. An Australian farmer couldn't go to his aunt's funeral because of pandemic restrictions there, so he paid his respects with a novel alternative, herding literally dozens of his sheep arranged in the shape of a heart. Drone shot video of pregnant ewes munching barley in a paddock while unwittingly expressing farmer Ben Jackson's affection for his beloved Auntie Deb was viewed by mourners at her funeral in the city of Brisbane in Queensland this week. Jackson was locked down at the time across the state border at his farm in Gyra in New South Wales, 270 miles away. Jackson told a local reporter, it took me a few goes to get it right, and the final result is what you see. That was as close to a heart as I could get. Well, if you view it and you go to our Facebook page to see it, it's a good-looking heart. Good for you, Farmer Jackson. Jackson started experimenting with making shapes with sheep to relieve the monotonous stress of hand-feeding livestock during a devastating drought over there across most of Australia that broke in the early months of the pandemic last year. He discovered that if he spelled the names of his favorite musical bands with grain dropped from the back of a truck, that the flock would roughly adopt the same shape for several minutes. Well, Jackson recounted that it certainly lifted my spirits back then. This heart that I've done for my auntie, it certainly seems like it's had a bit of an effect across Australia. Maybe we all just need to give ourselves a big virtual hug, he added. Well, Jackson said he was lucky to have any grain left on his property after a mouse plague this year that followed the drought. He continues to supplement the pregnant ewe's diet with grain to improve their condition before they give birth. Now, again, you can see this drone photo I mentioned on our Facebook page, @DGSCoins. The at sign, @DGSCoins. Yes, a quirky but uplifting story that we all need in these uncertain times. And that is this week's Levity is Golden. Thanks for listening. All right, back to the doldrums. Serious news. Orders for durable goods stalled unexpectedly last month, but manufacturers have plenty of backlogs to work through. There are tons of businesses across not just our economy, but everywhere else, especially in the industrialized world, with empty shelves as they wait for various manufacturers to ship the goods. In the U.S., this has been hampering sales while also driving inflation. Order backlogs offer a snapshot of just how much stuff manufacturers have yet to deliver. Unfilled orders, the backlog of manufactured goods grew another 0.3% last month to $1.3 trillion. It's according to the Census Bureau. That was the sixth consecutive month of gains. The backlog of core capital good orders climbed to a record high $231 billion. ING chief economist Jim Knightley says huge order backlogs are going to keep manufacturers busy. With customer inventories at all-time lows, manufacturers are also gaining pricing power, many of them passing their price increases on to their customers. And Grant Thornton's chief economist Diane Swank says backlogs in the manufacturing sector are expected to last well into 2022 to clear. Now, while that may sound good from a demand perspective, the pressure is high for manufacturers to compete. When it comes to unfilled orders for manufacturers, it's like being a bartender on a super busy night. It's good in the sense that you're three deep at the bar, but it can be bad if you're out of lime wedges or oranges or cherries especially, or you're running out of, you know, one kind of liquor and your other bartender just called in to tell you he's gotten another job. You're slammed, but yet your customers are going to find another place for a drink if you can't pick up the pace. Well, Too Big to Fail UBS economist Sam Coffin believes that while unfilled orders have been on the rise, shipment of goods have been rising even faster. He says the ratio of unfilled orders to shipments surged during the pandemic amid supply constraints. It's fallen back more now to a more normal ratio and doesn't look particularly high or low in the aggregate. In fact, shipments, he added, climbed 2.2% month over month to a record high $258 billion in July. The good news for manufacturers is they have a lot of stuff to make to meet the demand. The good news for their customers, apparently, is that this stuff is getting manufactured and shipped at an increasing rate despite the backlogs. Now, does that translate to transitory higher prices or prolonged inflation? You're right. Only time will tell. August isn't usually a month for fundraising or deal-making. Well, unless you're a member of Congress, in which case you're fundraising literally every day, or at least Monday through Friday. But tell that to the collateralized loan obligation market, which is having its most active month ever. New CLOs have closed at a pace not touched in the last decade, according to LCD. I think that's a sub-offering of the S&P Global Market Intelligence Group. And August isn't even over yet. I mean, CLOs are funds that invest in leveraged loans, or the loans of larger companies with lower credit ratings. And more CLOs mean more dry powder to support debt financing for private equity buyouts and merger and acquisition deals. 2021 has been a banner year for fundraising across many asset classes, including private equity. That's according to PitchBook. As of August 23rd, 17 plus billion in the U.S. CLOs had closed during the month so far. The previous monthly record was March 2015, 16.2 billion. And the third and fourth highest months were in February and June of this year, both tallying roughly 16 billion apiece. So plenty of more buyouts are in the works, and yeah, sure, they'll need financing. With this rate of CLO formations, doesn't look like that's going to be a problem. So along with that, stock buybacks, more dividends being issued on loans, you know, 0.1% interest rates. Yep, things are looking up for big business, right? Now, this sort of grabs my anger, frustration. I mean, 8 months after the federal government approved billions of dollars to help people pay their rent, much of it at the expense of landlords and landladies, more than 50 counties and cities across the country have yet to spend a single penny of it. Now, those numbers come from the Treasury Department's latest data on the distribution of rental assistance, which Congress first authorized last December, when they set aside an unprecedented $46 billion in two separate relief bills to help renters through the pandemic. Instead of creating a national program to distribute the money, however, lawmakers asked state and local governments to give out the funds, much as they do, say, Medicaid. Of the first $25 billion in rental assistance, states and local governments have spent $5.1. They dispensed another $1.6 in July. Roughly 60 areas had sent out zero in federal rental assistance through the end of June, including New York, which is sitting on $801 million, Puerto Rico, $325 million. While some areas have started their programs, many are still struggling to get aid out. Now, New York has now distributed $186 million, but Puerto Rico still zero. That's not good. State and local governments have faced pressure from the White House, as well as members of Congress and advocacy groups, as well as renters who began to question, where's the money? In programs that were up and running, applicants often face confusing paperwork requirements, similar to when pandemic unemployment assistance was rolled out last year. So now the Treasury Department's urging local governments to ditch the excessive paperwork and take renters at their word that they're facing financial hardship, instead of making them gather and submit several documents like court filings, pay stubs, bank statements, and the like. Now, the latest Treasury Department data go through July, so some areas may have started giving out money the first couple weeks of August, but other areas still barely begun. Look at Jersey City, New Jersey, didn't even open its application process until August 17th. Well, they're running up against deadlines. If they don't use at least 65% of their allocated funds by the end of September, the federal government has the authority to take it all back. Yesterday, the Treasury Department said programs that are unwilling or unable to deliver assistance quickly were at risk of losing their money. Even with the signs of improvement, aid is still moving slowly, and the longer it takes, the risk of more financial hardship or even eviction is going to rise for renters, the poorest of them. The federal government has tried to put in place additional safeguards, but they're only temporary and really could be stripped at any moment. For example, earlier this month, the CDC enacted a 60-day moratorium for non-payment of rent in counties particularly affected by the Delta variant. As cases surge once again, the ban remains in wide effect, replacing a broader moratorium that expired at the end of July. But this time a little different. It's also under legal attack. Only a day after the CDC reinstated the current moratorium, the Alabama and Georgia chapters of the National Association of Realtors filed a motion in federal court to stop the ban. So far, a federal judge in Washington has allowed for the moratorium to continue, but the real estate groups have appealed the decision and expect to take it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So we'll see what happens. Across the country, eviction proceedings are beginning. Landlords have lost billions in unpaid rent, many of them still with mortgages, as millions of renters who've lost income during the pandemic struggle to keep up with their bills. I don't know. This money might just come too late, ladies and gentlemen. According to the National Multifamily Housing Council, 80% of apartment households had made full or partial rent payments by the beginning of August. So there's still a good 20% out there affected. Now, I know we've been talking a lot about manufacturing and shipping recently. We've done so because they're two closely related factors, one of which is accounting for a lot of the rebound in economic growth on the one hand, and the other which is responsible for much of the rise in prices on the other. And now, industry executives in Asia, the world's factory floor, have a simple message on the global supply crunch. Get used to it. It's going to get worse before it gets better. That was the message being sent by those in the front line of production and transportation. What was hoped to be a short-term crunch now looks lasting well into 2022 and beyond. Karsten Michaelis from DHL Global Forwarding Asia Pacific says the combination of a year of disruption, lack of containers, port congestion, and shortage of vessels in the right positions is creating a situation where cargo demand far exceeds available capacity. Remember, later rather than sooner is the mantra to remember here. Let's stop there. I'll be back after another short break. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TimUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Call us at 1-800-375-4188 or look us up online at DGScoins.com. DGScoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. Our blog will be coming out sometime tomorrow. Now, time for weekly Wall Street Insights from Wall Street on Parade's Russ and Pam Martins, who write in today's newsletter that J.P. Morgan Chase is unique among the megabanks on Wall Street, and not in a good way. As we know, J.P. owns the largest federally insured bank in the U.S., despite a rap sheet that would make the Soprano family jealous. It's been charged by the U.S. Department of Justice with five felony accounts since 2014, admitting to every one of them. Its board of directors has left the same man, Jamie Dimon, at the helm of the bank as board chair and CEO during this dark period. JP's also the only American bank to ever be fined for using depositor money to gamble in derivatives. $6.2 billion of that they lost in a London debacle. Dimon was in charge at the bank then as well. JP is the only federally insured bank to be charged with two felony accounts for helping to facilitate the largest Ponzi scheme in history, the Bernie Madoff looting of thousands of investors. And despite this serial crime wave, the share price of JP's publicly traded stock has somehow managed to behave like the most well-managed bank in America. Well, either Americans have little or no knowledge of JP's misdeeds, or they have no problem investing their life savings in a repeat felon. Or perhaps something untoward is going on here with the trading of their stock. Since January 2014, when the Justice Department charged JP with its first two felony counts for its role in the Madoff swindle, to its closing price yesterday, the share of JP has significantly outperformed the S&P 500 index. During the same time span, JP has been trading the shares of its own bank stock in its own dark pool. As we've talked about in this program, dark pools have little oversight by regulators and allow trades to occur without the bid or ask side of the trade being first exposed to lit markets, such as licensed stock exchanges. With the exception of Wells Fargo, all of the mega banks on Wall Street are operating their own dark pools, whereas the SEC refers to them as alternative trading systems, ATSs. Well, until August 2017, JP operated only one dark pool known as JPMX. But then the bank added a second dark pool, which also began to trade in the shares of its own stock, known as JPBX. The Martins tell us that Wall Street's chummy self-regulator, FINRA, decided back then in 2014 to create the illusion of adding a little transparency to what's happening in dark pools. That's when FINRA began to publish stale 3-week-old trading data that were aggravated not by daily trading totals, but lumped together for an entire week, thus making it possible for researchers, investors to look for insider trading, front running, and other share price manipulations. Well, the first week for which dark pool trading data was released by FINRA was the week of May 12, 2014. FINRA released that data 3 weeks later, June 2nd, 2014. The Martins have found that for the past 7 years, J.P. Morgan Chase and other too big to fail banks have been trading in shares of their own bank stocks. In the most recent week reported by FINRA for dark pool trading, J.P.'s two dark pools traded over 518,000 shares of J.P. Morgan Chase stock in a total of 3,300 plus separate trades. J.P.'s own dark pool, JPMX, was the third largest dark pool trader in the share of its own stock for the week of August 2nd this year. In the 4 weeks from July 12th through the week of August 2nd, FINRA data show that J.P. Morgan's two dark pools made 22,000 plus trades in its own stock in the dark pool. J.P.'s federally insured bank does not operate the dark pools. They're operated by another unit of the company, J.P. Morgan Securities, LLC. The Security Exchange Act of 1934, which is still the law of the land, explains why it's a matter of national interest to protect U.S. markets from corruption by powerful players. Quote, frequently, the prices of securities on such exchanges and markets are susceptible to manipulation and control, and the dissemination of such prices gives rise to excessive speculation, resulting in sudden and unreasonable fluctuation in the prices of securities, which A, cause alternately unreasonable expansion and unreasonable contraction of the volume of credit available for trade, transportation, and industry in interstate commerce, B, hinder the proper appraisal of the value of securities and thus prevent a fair calculation of taxes owing to the United States and to the several states by owners, buyers, and sellers of securities, and C, to prevent the fair evaluation of collateral, valuation that is, of collateral for bank loans and or obstruct the effective operation of the national banking system and Federal Reserve System. Further, the law says national emergencies produce widespread unemployment and the dislocation of trade, transportation, and industry, and burden interstate commerce and adversely affect the general welfare. The SEC's new chair, by the way, Gary Gensler, has promised to take a close look at Wall Street's market structure. We agree with the Martins, who say there's no better place to start than Wall Street's dark pools. Now, here's a story that could have been today's levity is golden topic, except for the fact that it's an apparent serious attempt to deal with a serious problem. Frustrated by out-of-control increases in drug overdose deaths, California's leaders are trying something radical. They want the state to be the first to pay people to stay sober. The federal government has been doing it for years with military veterans, and research shows it's one of the most effective ways to get people to stop using drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine. Here's how the program would work. People would earn small incentives or payments for every negative drug test they receive over specified period of time, 6 weeks, 2 years, 5 years, whatever. Now, most people who complete the treatment without any positive test can earn a few hundred dollars. They usually get the money on a gift card. It's called contingency management. And California Governor Gavin Newsom has asked the federal government for permission to use tax dollars to pay for it through Medicaid, which covers nearly 14 million people in California. Meanwhile, a similar proposal is moving through California's legislature. It's already passed the Senate with no opposition, and is pending in the Assembly, where it even has a Republican co-author. Now, how much it costs depends on how many people participate. A program covering 1,000 people, for example, could cost as much as $286,000. Well, that's a pittance in California's operating budget total of more than $262 billion. The San Francisco AIDS Foundation, it's a nonprofit agency, runs a small privately funded contingency management program. It's where a fellow named Tyrone Clifford, who was addicted to meth, enrolled because they promised to pay him for every negative test over just 12 weeks. His first payment was $2. That increased slightly with each subsequent negative test for a total of $330. Well, Mr. Clifford said, "I thought I could do 12 weeks. I've done that before when my dealer was in jail." He said, "Besides, when I'm done, I'll have $330. Well, Clifford made it through the program without a positive test. But instead of using the $330 to buy more drugs, he bought a laptop computer so he could go back to school. Well, good for him. He says he hasn't used methamphetamine now in 11 years and works as a counselor at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. He's helping people who had the same addiction problems he did. Years old, said earning the money didn't matter that much, unlike some who struggle with drug addiction. Clifford said he always had a job and a house and was never much in danger of losing either. But he said watching his account grow with each negative test motivated him more than any other treatment program did. So we'll see what happened. I mean, Clifford acknowledged the program doesn't work for everybody. But added his treatment includes extensive group and individual counseling sessions that kept him accountable and made him feel part of, you know, that community. He considers the treatment a success, even if people don't make it without a positive test to the end. At least they're trying something, he said. Well, if California starts paying for contingency management treatment through Medicaid, Clifford thinks it would mean an explosion in similar addiction treatment programs across the state. California, like most of the country, has struggled with opioid abuse, including drugs like prescription painkillers, OxyContin, fentanyl, as well as heroin. But overdose deaths from stimulants in California nearly quadrupled between 2010 and 2019. The problem has gotten even worse since then. Preliminary data for the first 9 months of last year, when much of the state was locked down because of the pandemic, shows that stimulant overdose deaths jumped 42% compared to the year before. Well, let's end today's program with a final reminder of Jerome Powell's Jackson Hole speech tomorrow morning. I still believe that anyone who's expecting an announcement on when the Fed will start to taper the QE asset purchase program is going to be disappointed. I mean, surely Powell has the power to move markets with his words. And in fact, his speech will likely be another E.F. Hutton moment. And so regardless of whether he addresses the timing of the taper, markets, investors, traders are going to be interested in what he has to say. The theme of this year's Kansas City Fed Economic Policy Symposium is macroeconomic policy in an uneven economy. Well, multiple Fed watchers point to the July Federal Open Market Committee minutes that read, "No decisions regarding future adjustments to asset purchases were made at this meeting." Well, RSM chief economist Joe Persuella says that statement implies that Powell is in no hurry to front run the FOMC and announce the timing, magnitude, and roadmap of tapering operations that we expect will be announced in November and start in December. I wonder, because the theme of the symposium is targeting the uneven economy. I wonder if Powell may instead focus on income inequality and the Fed's broad-based and so-called inclusive employment goal. I mean, in testimony to Congress earlier this summer, he did acknowledge that joblessness continues to fall disproportionately on lower wage workers in the service sector and on African Americans and Hispanic people. And there's been a lot of criticism of the Fed in this area over the past, especially since the beginning of the pandemic, from advocacy groups, organizations, elected people who say Powell has overseen a Fed where income equality has grown to its worst level ever. Well, whatever. I mean, Powell will also likely talk more about climate change and how monetary policy and financial supervision could be adjusted in light of the long-term risks to the economy linked to climate change. Whether or not we agree with that or not, whether he uses a symposium to talk about the Fed's involvement in the oversight of cryptocurrencies and the development of central bank digital currency remains to be seen. In any event, tune in tomorrow, Friday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. That's when Powell will deliver his speech via Zoom. And that's all the time we have for today's show, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be back next Tuesday. I hope you have a fantastic weekend. Melody back tomorrow. I believe Butch is here as well. Also be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening to Financial Survival. Have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye. Have a plan. If I'm lucky, you're welcome.